Northern Education Committee order. Thank you all for being here. Today is Tuesday, February 4th, 2020. The time is 9 a.m. In attendance are Senator Coghill, Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, Senator Begich, and myself, Stevens. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we'll be continuing our hearing on sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 6, sponsored by Senator Begich, relating to early learning and literacy, and is being referred to as the Alaska Reads Bill. Intent today is to focus our attention primarily on the policy implications as regarding mandatory grade level reading and hold the bill for further review. We have some key folks joining us today who've been invited to frame our conversation around such a policy. Any questions or comments before we start? Senator Begich, any opening comments?
Just to repeat, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that the point of the bill is to ensure that we effectively address both, not just reading and the ability of students to read, but their ability in the long run to graduate and go on to meaningful lives. We've said this again and again throughout these hearings that a reading program without effective early education in pre-kindergarten doesn't work. We know that. The data shows that. A pre-kindergarten program without an effective reading program isn't sustainable in the long run. So this bill combines both with some extra intervention perspectives. We heard a lot about the level of intervention from and support from the state that the governor's office and myself support. So with that, we just open it up to the folks who are here to present.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Begich. Appreciate your efforts on this behalf of this bill. Enormous support for it. Throughout this building, a lot of important questions need to be delved into and understood better. So we begin with Bob Griffin. Glad to have you with us, Bob. Good to see you when you're not piloting an airplane, but pleased to have you with us. And he's going to be speaking to us from the Alaska Policy Forum.
Good morning to the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Griffin, representing the Alaska Policy Forum this morning. I've worked at the Policy Forum as education research fellow for the last 11 years as a volunteer in that capacity. Regardless of what you might see online, I haven't been paid tens of thousands of dollars to do this thing. It's a passion of mine that I've had for quite a long time. I'm also, of course, a member of the State Board of Education, but I'm not representing the State Board, though we have discussed this matter a lot in this particular issue. A special thanks to Senator Begich and Governor Devlin to have the courage to go forward with this bipartisan effort to help the kids of Alaska. Also, I want to thank Senator Hughes for her leadership on this particular issue with her bill that she put in last year, along with Representative Drummond and Posey Boggs and all the Reading Task Force people that added to this great stone soup of a bill that is, I think, going to be one of the best in the country when we finally get it through. Also, to Representative Ledoux, who put a similar reading bill in as early as 2013, that we've been chipping away at this, and I think we're finally have a good bipartisan understanding of what needs to be done. And finally, a great thanks to the staff of the DEED for all the hard work that they put in on this. Of course, this is the number one priority for the Alaska's Education Challenge and the State Board of Education. To improve our early childhood literacy. And though I'm going to talk about a little bit of bad news here in some of my slides and framing the question of why retention might be important, I always start with our kids are just as bright, our teachers are just as dedicated, and our parents love their kids just as much as anywhere else. It's policy decisions that are the key driver, I think, of some of our disappointing outcomes there. On this map that I have here shows there's only 13 states that don't have reading policies in the United States. Alaska is one of them. In the dark blue are the states that have the most comprehensive reading policies. And with the bill in its current form, I think we would be one of these dark blue. We would be the 12th dark blue state. So there's a lot of good components of this bill that when we look. We talked a couple weeks ago, Tom Kiley of the Education Commission of the States talked about the three main elements of prevention, intervention, and retention being the three components. This bill is very strong, really, in all those components. And if the policies that are recommended by the Foundation for Excellence in Education. We score very strongly in at least 12 of the 14 categories of the recommendations that they recommend for a strong reading bill. And moving on here, just to frame why we're here, a little bit of a reading test here, but going back to 2003, and this is not a random date, this is the first year that NAEP was required by all 50 states, comparison of Alaska and Florida. Florida was pretty average back in 2003. Alaska, we had some deficiencies, especially in areas of reading already back then, but we were in blue, in that we were ahead of Florida in math for kids who qualify in eighth grade for free or reduced lunch and non-free or reduced lunch. And in the work that I do, I always break things down by economic strata just because it makes it so much easier to compare high poverty states to low poverty states when you break it down by the economic strata, because there's generally nationwide about a 30-point NAEP difference between kids who qualify for free or reduced lunch and kids who don't qualify for free or reduced lunch. Move on quickly here to the next slide. When we jump forward to the comparison of 2003 to 2013, Alaska's actually slid in our standings pretty dramatically. We're a bottom five finisher, noted by the red, in seven of the eight categories, pretty close to eight out of the eight. In the meantime, Florida, who was the original model of the comprehensive reading policies, actually California was the first one to have strong retention policies, but they didn't have the strong, the 14-point checklist that Florida went through prior to that. And in that time frame, Florida has risen to a top five finisher in four of the eight categories, and has increased their standing nationwide and in all eight categories. And it's, I think, really important to note here that longitudinally, these policies that were put in place in Florida were not just an accounting trick to make the kids in fourth grade scores look better. They've had downstream effects on eighth grade. As you'll note there, in free or reduced lunch, eighth grade reading, Florida has gone from 38th to 5th while they've had these policies in place. One of the kind of offensive narratives that cropped up last year was that our white kids are doing fine. It's just our native kids were dragging our test scores down. I had, up to that point, had never broken things down by ethnicity, but this drove me to build a few charts here. And specifically, this is white kids who do not qualify for free or reduced lunch. Their parents are too wealthy to qualify for free or reduced lunch. The difference between 2003 and 2017, in this case, it's about the same for the 2019 results, but we're second to last with a slight decline in our scale score, where Florida, during this time frame, had a 14-point rise in their test scores for kids in this category. So pretty much across the spectrum, we're having issues with our reading capabilities there. I'm not going to talk about this slide very long, but one of the things that Florida and Mississippi are highlighted there in yellow, their increase in per-student spending and average daily attendance was between 2003 and 2018. Was about national average, even though they added pre-K and added these reading programs that we are considering here today.
Yes, Senator Begich.
I just want to make a comment for the record, Mr. Chairman. Usually I'm in a better frame of mind in the morning, Mr. Griffin, but you've repeated a number of times a comment about our comments in this committee about Alaska Natives, and I don't appreciate them. I'm going to say one more time that you've misrepresented my position on that a number of times. And when we were discussing test scores, we talked in this committee about rural and urban test scores. Your comments that continue to characterize that as a native and white issue are not appreciated by me. And I recognize that we are working together today on this legislation, but that really has hit me hard for the last year and a half, and I just really want to put that on the record. I'm disappointed that you've just brought it up again.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Yes, please, Senator.
I appreciate Senator Begich's concern, but I also want to say I think it's important to get it on the record the way it was presented, because there was an op-ed that described it in those same terms, and it wasn't correct. And so, you know, what Mr. Griffin is basically saying is that there are many of our Alaska Native children that are doing fabulously, and that's the point saying it is the op-ed, which was very disturbing to me, was claiming that Alaska Natives were dragging down their test scores. So this is to get the data correct that is not true. So I understand your concern, Senator Begich, but I think it was important because of that op-ed. Thank you.
I know these are sensitive issues about racial matters whenever they're brought up, and no intent to offend anyone in this. But I think what you're saying, if I understand your comments, that Caucasian children in urban Alaska are doing worse than in the past as well.
They are. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to expound upon that. And I apologize, Senator Begich, that it was in no way aimed at you. I don't actually remember having that discussion with you. That actually is framed as Senator Hughes mentioned. It was the op-ed from Dermot Cole last year that was repeated around the Capitol on the chamber floors a couple times. That the fact that we do have disappointing test scores when you break it down by Native kids, but I had never even looked at that point until that op-ed had come out, and it just seemed odd that our upper middle income kids at that point were near the bottom in the nation, that somehow that the Native test scores would be responsible for dragging our test scores down. It's we have issues across the spectrum.
Yes, Senator Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, Bob, let's move on with the presentation.
Sure. Thank you, sir.
And try to move forward with the, what I'm hoping will be a way of bridging all gaps. And I appreciate your comments earlier today as you opened your presentation about how we are working together in a bipartisan manner to improve reading and to improve education for all Alaskans.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Senator Bob.
Really quickly, here's a quick analysis on getting really to the meat of the retention policies. I've taken out a slice here of fourth grade reading NAEP gains for the 15 states that have Florida type policies that have been enforced for at least three NAEP cycles. NAEP, of course, is every odd year. So all of these states have had very similar to the Florida programs for the last 6 or 7 years, long enough to have three NAEP slices. And we look specifically at the free and reduced lunch kids, because the data indicates those are the kids, the free reduced lunch kids, the ethnic minorities, are the ones that have benefited the most from these policy gains. And when you do the comparison of all those states during their first three NAEP cycles, the seven states with strong retention policies have about eight times the average point gain compared to the states with the weaker retention policies. And that's just an observation that I'm throwing out there. It's and this indicates, again, the growth in the free and reduced lunch student population for fourth grade after the first three NAEP cycles that they've had these policies in place. The last thing I was just going to touch on, and the next guest speaker will be able to cover this a lot more conclusively, but the fact that there we get a lot of feedback a lot of time that all the research indicates that we should not retain kids, and there's a lot of good research. There's a large body of evidence, and some of it was driven by the 1998 California decision to start mandatory retention of kids. But California really didn't have the backup of the 14-point policies that they have in Florida. And since then, there's been a lot of good research. I have seven of them posted up here. I have those studies and another eight here in my pamphlet here that talk about some of the positive aspects of retention. So the research on this is at least mixed, and we're finding more and more there's some positive aspects of retaining the kids. And really with that, I really don't have in conclusion, I think the retention piece of this does make a big difference on the outcomes in the end, and it's something we look forward to discussing.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. I appreciate your comments and your involvement. You may not be entirely prepared for this, but can you give us just a brief idea of the difference between those strong retention states and weak retention states?
Absolutely, I can. There's, as a matter of fact, I'll give you some of the examples of things that are kind of classified as the weak retention states. In Arkansas, a student is only retained when they don't participate in an individual individualized education program, or an IEP. In Oklahoma, a committee must make a unanimous decision in order for a student to be retained. In Colorado, it's a joint school and parent decision that is proposed, but the retention decision is finally made by the superintendent. In New Mexico, parents can refuse the first retention. In Iowa, students that are not retained if they attend summer school, regardless of the outcomes of their summer school experience. In Minnesota, Utah, and Virginia have good comprehensive reading policies, but they have no official retention policy at all.
Mr. Chair, could he flip back to slide 7, because those were the states he was just talking about?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Hughes.
A visual.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Okay, and on the right-hand side, you see the weak retention states, Mr. Griffin.
And I did the descriptions of what makes those, in my assessment, but anyway, the weak retention states is that they don't, they have significant wiggle room in their retention legislation or statute.
And then on the other hand, briefly, can you talk about the stronger retention states and what their policies might be?
The strong retention states, as a general and part of the 14-point guidelines from the Excellence in Education, of kids who should be able to read should need to be at a basic minimum proficiency. And this is something in our bill that says that kids should be retained if they not at reading at grade level. That would be a little bit aggressive compared to what other places have. I think the cut line would be more reasonable with the kids that are far below proficiency, like in our PEAKS test scores. Because kids who are score at that far below proficiency rate, we don't know where the bottom is. We don't know if they're going through third grade and not knowing the alphabet. We have no understanding of what the bottom level of that is. And that's in Florida and other places, that kids who do not qualify for the very many exemptions, and the kids who are unable to pass the written test or the alternative assessments or show a portfolio of their work that they can read at a basic proficiency level, those kids should probably seriously be considered for retention.
Thank you very much. I think that's clearly going to be one of the big issues as this bill progresses, is the retention matter, and I know we'll be hearing much more about it from all sorts of folks on all sides of that issue. Senator Hughes, a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look at that chart and I think about our children, I want Alaska to land on the left side of there with a greater gain. And I know, and I like to call it the proficiency-based promotion policy, PPP, rather than focusing on the retention. And as I embarked on this particular policy issue, and I made a statement, I believe, in our opening committee, that if we accomplish nothing else, this session, but we're able to get this through, this could be a game changer for the for these students and their futures and for our state as a whole. But if we continue to socially promote, we're not going to get those outcomes. And I would propose that we really think hard about where we want, because if you look, some of this, the states, and in fact, Colorado has been is a model that's been discussed as part of what we're following, but look where Colorado is. It's over on the right, and it actually their scores went down in those first 6 years. So I would ask members to really think about the students, because with some teeth in the bill, if we do it right and we can learn from the past states where perhaps their number of students held back did initially spike, we could avoid that, Mr. Chair, if we phase in the retention by only, for instance, it would only apply to kindergartners in the first year. You couldn't hold the first, second, third grade teachers and students responsible for something where they haven't had the full program. But in the first, second, third grade, you want those children to have every opportunity. So we could ask the Board of Education, for example, to develop an incentive program for those teachers who reached a certain measurable amount of progress with those students, so those children are benefiting. Then in year two, the retention policy would only apply to kindergarten and first grade, and the incentive program would be for second and third. Third year, the retention policy would apply to K-1 and 2, incentive for grade 3. And finally, by the fourth year, the retention policy would apply to all four grades. I want to see Alaska land on the left side. I don't think that we should fear a proficiency-based promotion policy, because obviously the outcomes will be greater, and our students will have a diploma that will be valuable. I want to say, too, as far as the research, most of the research, this is my understanding, and we may have someone can speak to this because I'm not a PhD researchist, but I will say that I think a lot of the studies were based on students being retained where there was not massive intervention like this program. So by the time a child who was retained in kindergarten, first, second, third grade, they continued to be behind the curve in fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, feeling pretty badly about themselves because they were failing pretty much across the board. So yes, psychologically, emotionally, was it traumatic for them to be held back? Yes, but it's also psychologically and emotionally damaging at the point they are, say if they're in ninth grade, because they're failing in so many subject matters. Whereas if we had a proficiency-based promotion policy, those students that were held back in kindergarten or first grade, by the time they get to ninth grade, they'd likely be succeeding across the board. They're probably not going to feel poorly about themselves. So the research really is not applied to this kind of scenario. And so we should be careful about applying something that's zucchinis to something that's, you know, that's apples. We're comparing apples to zucchini, I think, in many of these studies, because with this kind of policy in place, I think that our 7th, 8th, 9th graders, high schoolers will be successful and feeling pretty good about themselves because of the great intervention that would be taking place. And I would love to see a student that maybe is held back in second grade for reading, that they could, the goal would be to catch them up with their cohort. And I think that should be a goal of the school principals and of the districts. If a child needs extra intervention and needs to be retained in a year, they could continue if they're doing fine in their mathematics, that they could continue on grade level with that, and that with the hope that they could be back with their cohort. So I think we should not fear a proficiency-based promotion policy, and I hope the members would consider that and be careful about the research and understand that it does not necessarily apply to students who've been through this type of a program.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I appreciate your consistency in this and your contribution in the past. Yes, Senator Begich.
If we could turn to number two.
Slide two.
Slide two, please, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little one before that. Page two.
Yes.
You'll note that you mentioned earlier that the policy forum hoped we would one day be in the dark blue states there.
Yes, sir.
You made that comment earlier. And, of course, at least two of those states, Colorado and Oklahoma, that are in the dark blue are what you also list as weak retention states. There's also in the second to darkest category, there's Iowa. And so, I mean, you know, I just want to kind of just kind of frame the conversation a little bit. First, right now, any school district in Alaska has the ability to choose to retain kids. Isn't that the case?
It is. It's true. Yes, through the chair.
And Bob, you testified in one of the comments you made about the bill, and one of the things you liked about the bill is that it not only lays out a comprehensive reading policy, it lays it out very detailed, in fact, what that comprehensive reading policy would be, and has a conditional in there for retention.
Yes,
which
sir.
You identified as one of the key points in the 14 points that I'm aware of, and I know that you are aware of as well. And so it meets your feeling is that the way the bill is construed, it would really put us, if it passed, in that category of the dark blue states that are on the map. If we can maintain consistency with really clear reading outcomes and with known policies that a kid shouldn't necessarily progress if they aren't meeting those, because we're going to be putting plans around that and structure around that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And through the chair, Senator Begich, this is I've looked at a lot of reading bills, and this is one of the better ones. And of the 14 points, probably the retention gets the most attention, but it is probably one of it's actually a little bit of the glue that kind of makes people pay attention to these things. But the other 13 points beyond retention are very, very important in order to create better outcomes that we're looking for. So
thank you, Mr. Griffin. I'm sorry, but I need to interrupt here. And I hate to stop you, but we have four presenters. If you make it very quick.
I will. And just my concern is also ensuring parents have a voice in that kind of a decision, and I just want to be sure that you support that as well.
I absolutely do. I think universal to all those policies are parents' ability to appeal the decisions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Thank you, Senator. Fascinating discussion. We're making great progress here, and now we need to move on to Dr. Marcus Winters from Boston University, and he is online. Dr. Winters, can you hear us?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me to join you here. I'm happy to talk about this work and answer any questions if I can be helpful. So my name is Marcus Winters. I'm an associate professor at Boston University in the Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. I'm an economist. I use quantitative research methods to study the effects of modern education policies. And one of the things I've studied a lot over time has been these test-based promotion policies, and in particular I've studied Florida's policy over a long period of time and in a few different ways. And so in my presentation today, I'm just planning to lay out some of the few basic findings that I have from the studies with a brief nod to how these comparisons are made. I'm really happy to go into more details if that's helpful, and also talk about the research on this more generally. I'll talk about research that I've done in Florida that's addressed really three issues associated with Florida's test-based promotion policy. One is the effect of retention under the policy on later student outcomes. And to clarify this, and I think this is an important point that was brought up just a moment ago, that here I'm looking at the effect of retention, but what I'm really looking at is the effect of retention under the policy. And with that, the other kind of interventions that come under the policy as well, so that are tied to Florida's policy. And then second, I look at, what's the impact that the policy has on student performance within the third grade, which I think is an important part of these policies that hasn't gotten received as much attention as it deserves. And third is some information about the cost of retaining students, under Florida's policy and under such policies. So the first thing we'll focus on is work that I've done measuring the effect of the treatment under Florida's policy, so retention and the other interventions that come with it during the retained year. And I've done this study for several times now in Florida. So my first study evaluating the effect of retention under Florida's policy was it came 2 years after the first class had been retained. And then slowly over time, we've have updated that work. Where the most recent work. My co-authors and I were able to study the effect of retention under the policy, and the first group cohort of students who were retained under the policy were finally graduating high school and moving on into college. So we can look at kind of longer-term outcomes and their trajectory of performance. And the way the study works is, in essence, what we do is we compare the later outcomes of students who scored, quote-unquote, just below the threshold on the reading exam, and those students were much more likely to be retained because the policy, it triggered the policy. And we compare their performance to the students who in the third grade scored just above the threshold, and those students were very unlikely to be retained. This is a technique in research we call regression discontinuity. It is a very, very strong research technique in economics. It's used very frequently. We consider it to be really as strong as a randomized control trial in many ways. And the reason is that what it allows us to do is compare two students who are very, very similar to each other. And we think they're very similar to each other in lots of ways, in all ways really that we can observe and not observe about them. Basically, these are kids who, one more question, guessed right or wrong on the exam, would have led them to be on one side or the other of that threshold. So essentially, randomness determined whether that student was retained or promoted. And what we do is we follow those students over time in order to see the differences in their outcomes. And what we find is that students who were retained under Florida's policy, when we look at them several years later, that retention had a very large immediate test score increase for immediately following the retention. That test score increase faded over time as students progressed through school. But when we compare students at the same grade level, it was still the effect was still large and positive as late as the 10th grade, which was the last year that we have test scores for students in Florida. We didn't see a significant effect on high school graduation rate, in part that's because the estimates it's very imprecisely estimated. We also didn't see a significant effect on college entry, but we did see differences in student performance in high school, where students who were retained in the third grade under the policy had significantly and substantially higher GPAs in high school, and also took fewer remedial high school courses. So we see this large bump in test scores for the students who are retained, and that bump it fades over time as students progress through school, but it's still apparent in their high school performance as well. Moving to the next slide, the next thing that I've studied is looking at this additional question of, instead of just focusing on the students who are retained by this policy, who, deserve a lot of attention, but one thing, a fundamental idea about these policies also is that they should impact the performance of students and schools as they try to avoid this perceived need for retention. So what I've done is looked at whether the policy affects everyone else in the third grade during that third grade year. So we might expect that students and teachers and others in the school are going to put more effort on pushing kids above that line to increase their performance in reading so that they don't fall below that cutoff. And what I did in Florida was I measured if there was a significant increase in third grade test scores in the first year of the test-based promotion policy that we didn't see, that was not apparent within the school for fourth graders and fifth graders. And the idea here is that the test-based promotion policy, if it has an effect on students, in that gateway grade, there's a lot of incentive to push student performance in those earlier grades, but it doesn't have a direct incentive anyway on the later grades. And what I found was that that adoption of the policy led to a meaningful positive effect on third grade performance, so prior to the retention decision. during the policy's first year. I'll also say, so I've recently conducted, I have a working paper where I do a very similar study in Arizona, which adopted a similar policy as Florida's, but about a decade later, and we find almost identical effects in that other context. The third thing that I look at that is worth considering is whether retention under the policy is costly to taxpayers in particular. One issue with retaining students is that it might be very expensive. So our common concerns are that essentially we could be talking about an additional year of schooling at the average per pupil expenditure for that kid for state taxpayers. That's much more expensive than some other reading intervention, for instance. And the other thing we might consider is that the retention imposes some cost on the treated students as well. So being held back in the third grade might lead you to enter the labor market 1 year later or enter college 1 year later than you would have otherwise. And that has impacts on people's future earnings as they move forward. But the point that I make in this paper is that these costs, they're real, but the costs have been overstated in prior work. And in particular, prior cost estimates have been overstated for a couple of reasons. The first is that a student who's retained under the policy does not represent an additional cost to taxpayers for several years until after the treatment is given. So a student who is held back in the third grade should cost the same as they would had they moved into the fourth grade that year. And what that means is that the actual cost of retaining that student doesn't actually show up for that kid for several years, in fact, until they're kind of in the 12th grade is when it should show up if they have continued progress through schooling after that. So we need to discount the cost of retention, back up by 10 years. And that can have an effect depending on some assumptions that we can make about inflation, about interest rates, and the like. But by far the bigger effect, though, is that when we're thinking about retention that's specifically targeted to test-based promotion policies, it's important to keep in mind that that's not happening in a vacuum. And so one thing that I show in some of my work is that the retention, being retained in the third grade under Florida's policy, is associated with much less than a full year of additional schooling for that kid. And the reason is that many of those students who are retained under the test-based promotion policy, if the policy wasn't there, many of those students either would have been retained in the third grade at that time or might be retained in a later grade, in the fourth grade, in the fifth grade, and on. And what the policy does is it kind of, for those students, it just moves the retention into that earlier grade. And so they actually end up spending much less than a full year in schooling on average. So, and that substantially reduces the cost of the policy. And one thing I show in Florida is that the benefits that should come from the increased student performance far outweighed the cost that we can tie to the retention when we take those factors into account. So that's a summary of that research within Florida. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Winters. Appreciate your contribution. So when you say less than a full year, are you talking summer school? Are you talking intervention with tutors? How's that handled in Florida?
So some of it is that some students might move up and reenter their cohort again. So there's a little bit of that. But by far the biggest difference is that if a student who's retained in the third grade under the policy, if that policy hadn't have been there, that student might have been retained anyway. Right. So, and for that student, the policy actually didn't increase the number of years that they remain in school if they progress through schooling the same way they would have otherwise. Similarly, even if that kid wasn't going to be retained in the third grade, many of those students, if the policy didn't exist, will instead be retained in the fourth or the fifth grade or a later grade. And what we found was that by being retained in the third grade under the policy, it dramatically reduced the chances that those students were retained in later grades. So it turned out for those students who were held back under the policy, who would have been held back even if the policy wasn't there, they don't spend any additional time in schooling. If they progress all the way through graduation, they're going to spend the same amount of time they would if the policy hadn't existed. So for those students, when we include those students in the calculation, what ends up happening is that the cost to taxpayers is substantially less than a full year of schooling because many of those students aren't spending an additional full year.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Any questions of Dr. Winter? Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, I was wondering, thank you for your testimony, Dr. Winters, and for your work. I was wondering if you factored in reduced special education costs, because we were in an earlier hearing understanding that some students actually end up where there's not a reading program, going into special education programs, which are costly. And also, from what I gathered from your testimony, you only were considering the cost to a district, the cost to school budgets, and we're not considering societal costs, because there is data showing that that students who don't learn to read often end up incarcerated and on Medicaid, on public assistance. So strictly was your study on school cost, and then also did you consider special education costs being reduced?
Yeah, very good questions. So the second one first. And you're exactly right. So we didn't. So I'm not able to consider those reduced costs from decreased incarceration through other kind of public services, simply because we just don't have the data to show whether those students actually receive fewer of those services. We do have the data showing that retention increased their test scores, and there's data that can link an increase in test scores to some of those reduced services, but it's not nearly as strong. So you're right. So that is an additional reduction in cost that might come about, but we just couldn't prove it in the same way in the empirical work. The special education issue is also interesting. In Florida, in our study, we didn't see a large decrease in the probability that the retained students were placed in the special education. So that cost saving, at least for the average student, wasn't really there. I do think that there is work showing, and I think fairly convincing work showing, that increasing student performance reduces the probability that they get a new IEP, particularly in the category of specific learning disability. One reason that we might not see as large of an effect from Florida's policy is that a lot of SLD classifications have happened by the third grade, but it was something that empirically we just didn't see a very large effect one way or another. So that's not part of the cost estimate here either.
A follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator,
in your study, were you seeing that these states were primarily, if they were going to decide not to promote a child based on proficiency or a severe deficiency in achievement, was it primarily at third grade, or were you seeing them doing that at kindergarten, first, second grade? Because I know some people who are concerned about the psychological impact based on some of the research, which I mentioned before, doesn't really pertain so much to this type of work. But it's the older the child is, the greater the chance that there might be some concerns. So are we seeing these states deciding to have a child stay in kindergarten before moving to first grade, or is it primarily at the third grade level where it's happening?
No, that's a really interesting question. I'm not aware of work that's really systematically looked at whether there's a change in retention rates prior to a student entering the third grade. It makes some intuitive sense to me that schools might respond that way, but I haven't seen work that's really systematically done that. And my study has been focused on measuring the effect of retention under the policy itself in Florida. So that's all happening in the third grade. So that hasn't been something that I've been able to look at directly.
And then one quick question.
Senator Hughes, please.
And Dr. Winters, could you comment, if you were listening earlier, to a proposal I was sort of thinking out loud regarding a combination of a phased-in approach for a proficiency-based promotion policy where you'd pair it with incentives and only the the cohort of students who've actually had full advantage of the great reading program would be the full policy would apply to them. Have you seen anything like that in other states? Do you think that is might be a solution? And because we don't want to spike, we don't. If we were to do something and make it a little more a stronger policy, we don't want the first year or two to have huge numbers of students have to repeat a grade. So a phased-in approach seems like you could prevent any kind of spike. Do you think that would work, and have you seen it anywhere?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know direct evidence that has looked at the effect in that way. So, and I definitely don't know work that's looked at, specifically providing incentives in order to meet that. I do think that there's evidence that schools do respond to these policies by making improvements prior to the third grade. So first I'd point to, so my results here where I see this jump in third grade performance relative to the later grades suggests that there's a response there where schools are, trying to make gains in order to push students over that line. I can't really look at earlier grades here just because the test scores don't exist, but it would stand to reason that schools might be responding there. In the similar study that I did in Arizona, where I also saw that third grade effect, there was also some qualitative research done by folks at WestEd that was attached to that policy, and so it's not quantitative empirical in this way, but they did report through interviews with school leaders and with teachers that schools in early grade were focusing on reading instruction in early grades and making changes there in order to try to improve student performance there. So I think there's reason to believe that schools will respond to that. It's feasible that you could increase that effort, prior to the third grade with some incentives and with other kind of additional resources. I know, like in Florida, they focused on retention was kind of is the end of well not the end of but it's the culmination of the policy there, but other kind of changes with reading instruction in those earlier grades was going on. I'd also point out that the other thing that can be done in order to one thing that needs to be considered when adopting these policies is where you draw where that proficiency line is drawn, or not proficiency, but where the line for that triggers the policy is drawn. And that's something that is different in the several different states. So Florida saw a very large increase in retention because that level one, the line between level one and level two is actually a fairly high level relative to the distribution of reading performance within the state. Arizona, where I've tried to study this before, so I see a positive effect within the third grade. I've tried to study the effect of that of retention under that policy, but it turned out to be very difficult because the cutoff was set so low that very few students actually ended up being retained. So they didn't experience a jump either. But in part, that's because they set the threshold was set at a very low level. So, and I think that that's something that you as policymakers need to think of is what makes sense for drawing that, where's the best place to draw that line, take into consideration wanting to make sure that students are getting the treatment if they need it, but also in mind of what that means for how many students might be affected.
Okay, thank you, Senator Hughes. I'll ask you to hold your question. Senator Coghill has a question. And he's changed his mind, so okay, no problem. We need to move on, though, and we'll have a chance, hopefully, to get back to Dr. Winters. Thank you again, sir, for your comments. We really appreciate them. Moving on to Angie Galanos, Director of Literacy, School Readiness, and Preschool for the State of Colorado, former Early Learning Administrator at the Alaska Department of Education. Ms. Galanos, are you with us? Can you hear me?
I am there. Can you hear me?
Yes, clearly. Thank you so much for being with us. If you'd put yourself on the record, please, and then give us your testimony, I'd appreciate it.
Great, thank you. So my name is Angie Galanos, for the record. I am a former Alaska teacher and former employee of the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. And as you said, in Alaska, I served as both the literacy content specialist for the Department of Education and also as the director for early childhood education. And again, just to restate, I'm currently the director of the Colorado Department of Education preschool through third grade office. And in Colorado, the preschool through third grade office supports the Colorado state-funded preschool program and our K-3 reading initiative called the READ Act. So I want to share two programs Colorado has implemented that can be used as opportunities for reflection as you move forward with Senate Bill 6, and then happy to answer questions after. But first, I want to share that Colorado has implemented state-funded part-day preschool for 31 years. The Colorado preschool program is showing strong outcome results for the children who participated in the program. And I just want to point out that in Colorado preschool program, those children who participated were more likely to graduate on time when compared to similar peers. They performed better on third grade summative assessments, and they were less likely to be identified as having a significant reading deficiency. So the investment that Colorado has placed into 3- and 4-year-old children is showing strong long-term results. I'm going to make sure that you have a copy of the 2021 Colorado Preschool Program Legislative Report that has all of our outcome data, just so that we can share that with you. And just for a note, I'll make sure that you know the pages that will direct you to those outcome results. But just to transition, I want to say that Colorado has learned that the purpose of a preschool program is not just school readiness alone, and that school readiness is really just one step of that child's academic preparation. For the impact of high-quality preschool to be seen, children must continue to receive those benefits of a quality education into the early grades. And in Colorado, we've committed to a stronger connection of efforts across preschool through third-grade systems, because we believe this integrated approach builds upon the successes that we've seen in the Colorado preschool program and will help more students stay on track for school success. So in addition to the Colorado preschool program, Colorado also joins 37 other states who have implemented K-3 reading initiatives and who are committed to supporting early grade reading from the start. The 2018-2019 school year marks the fifth full year of implementation for the Colorado READ Act. We know that we've seen a deep commitment from the teachers here, school leaders, and parents, but we also realize that we need to see better outcomes in reading. We know clearly it takes time for teachers and parents to work together to really successfully support students' reading acquisition, and we've been really conscious about consistently monitoring for the best outcomes. We don't consider any lack of significant progress to be a lack of success, but rather an opportunity for us to recommit and refocus our efforts, and I'm going to talk about that more in a minute. I really believe that Alaska can learn from Colorado. And the 37 previously mentioned states when reflecting on the bill in front of you. As I mentioned, many states have K-3 reading policy, and while Alaska's bill and Colorado's bill are very different, I want to point out that almost all K-3 reading bills have the following things in common. So most of the states that I'm talking about that have K-3 policies have policies that really relate to screening, assessment, and collaboration with parents on individual planning. The large majority of states use a screener that is valid and reliable at demonstrating which students will be most at risk to fail third grade assessments. The screener is used in a way to identify students with a reading deficiency. It monitors progress for students with a reading deficiency in K-3, and it really supports the notification of parents of those students and helps support create an individual reading plan so that interventions can be collaborative between the parents and the schools when you're identifying students with a significant reading deficiency. So again, screening is really critical for supporting intervention, and intervention plans have to be written with that knowledge, because intervention plans written without knowing which areas of reading are deficient in children can't really help provide accurate planning. Quality screeners that are discrete and discrete enough to flag students who are likely to fail state outcome tests, typically provided at grade 3, will stop a pattern of failure. So I just want to point that out. In Colorado, ongoing screening and statewide reporting allowed us to identify exactly how our Colorado READ Act was being implemented and allowed us to quickly make the changes when we needed to. Other interventions that are similar across the country are the policies related to intensive interventions for children who need it, and as you've been speaking about, when more is needed, they have policies around third grade retention. Only a few of the states have policies related to direct state support from the Department of Education. In Colorado, we provide specific grants to schools and districts, and those grants, are known as the early literacy grants in Colorado, has shown very strong outcomes. Those grants, those early literacy grants in Colorado, provide direct support through coaching, intervention services, and professional development. And I want to point out that Senate Bill 6, which you're looking at, is following states that have made significant progress by providing that direct support, such as Mississippi, Arizona, and North Dakota. The bill before you, again, and the Colorado bill are really dramatically different. And before I line out how Alaska can use Colorado as a tool to learn from, I want to stress the importance of time and the need to understand science-based reading research. This is a critical point and one that you're going to need to be very clear on. Many in education really haven't understood how to teach children to read, even though we've had mountains of evidence for the last 30 years. Educators can hold on to practices that are not effective and will not help children learn to read. And it's important to know what we mean when we align ourselves with the research on how children learn to read. And I also want to make a note, and we've learned this in Colorado, that change is hard and changing practices is difficult. But when I speak of the science of reading, I'm defining it like this. I'm referencing over 30 years of research compiled in thousands of studies concluding similar findings of how the human brain processes written text across multiple languages. And these studies provide conclusive evidence about how people learn to read, why some struggle, and the type of instruction that's shown to have the greatest impact on reading outcomes. So Colorado's learned lessons along the way with science-based reading statewide implementation. We recognize that we had implementation challenges and the need for greater intensity to support student reading outcomes. And the State Board of Education and our Colorado legislature worked to make changes to our READ Act in 2019. So in Colorado's revision, Senate Bill 19-199, that bill passed last year with unanimous support, a rare occurrence, where 100% of the General Assembly supported the reauthorization of this bill. And then the bill was signed into law by Governor Polis in May of last year. So I want to break down some of the reasons why Colorado lawmakers reauthorized the bill, because there are reasons that might offer an opportunity for reflection on Senate Bill 6. So I have four kind of key points. But first I want to just point out the need to understand the metrics that you're using for success. In Colorado, success in the K-3 reading initiative was defined as a reduction in children identified with a significant reading deficiency, as demonstrated by one of seven district choice screening tools. So each year, approximately the same number of children in Colorado were shown to be have a significant reading deficiency, about 14 to 16%. However, Colorado didn't measure the number of students who were newly identified and the number of students who were no longer identified. So essentially, we had no way to measure the flow of students who were coming in as newly identified with a significant reading deficiency and the flow of students who are making progress or out of SRD. So this would make it seem as if the rates of significant reading deficiencies in children were stagnant, when in fact we have no information that confirm that data. Alaska can start by ensuring that the metrics that you use for measurement measure student growth. You'll want to see how many children move between benchmark points on a reliable and valid screening tool. This way you can demonstrate how much progress children are making in reading. You'll also want to define what success looks like in Alaska, and I want to note that most state summative assessments only measure a child's ability to read and understand grade-level text. Summative assessments can't tell you if a child has the ability to decode actual words in the text presented. So a reading submeasure may be thought of kind of help you identify whether poor performance on a state assessment is related to comprehension of the text or lack of ability to decode the words. Another key point that I think you want to note that isn't in this bill but that Colorado has is that Colorado provides per pupil funding for each child identified with a reading deficiency. School districts get approximately $650 per child for every child who's identified. And again, they identify using one of seven different assessments. And two things happen here. First, there isn't really direct comparability between the assessments. Selecting one assessment and using that as a baseline and a measure could be a real opportunity for Alaska to provide a more aligned approach. And second, carefully think through allocating specific dollars attached to each child. a district comes to depend on a certain amount of money and funding available, which could de-incentivize reducing the number of children who are identified as needing per pupil dollars. Alaska's bill isn't providing per pupil funding, and rather funding districts as a whole. And coincidentally, I just want to point out that I think Oklahoma is the only other state that provides per pupil funding, like Colorado does. Up until the changes for the Colorado bill, also the Colorado Department of Education was prohibited from asking districts how the funds they received per pupil were spent. So the department had no way of knowing whether or not the funds were being used on interventions that were required and identified as effective. So with the reauthorization, Colorado now has the opportunity to review district budgets and authorize allowable uses of funding. So another point, budget and expenditure monitoring can help ensure that funds are being provided for the interventions needed. Couple more just really quickly. I want to point out that Colorado, as along with many other states, realized that many teachers did not know how to teach children to read based on reading science and effective practices. Many districts, and I can tell you that in Alaska as a teacher, I believe, and in my work with the Alaska Department of Education, I believe many districts are implementing reading practices that are not only ineffective, but possibly detrimental to reading development. So here in Colorado, the legislature mandated that all K-3 teachers in the state pass an approved course in foundational reading. Additionally, Colorado is taking a close look at the types of instructional programs districts are using, the professional development provided, and the ways that higher education is preparing teachers in the state. Colorado now has an approved list of instructional programs, and we're working with our Educator Effectiveness Division to approve teacher prep programs so that we can assure that those higher education institutions are providing coursework in evidence-based reading practices. And I've been listening in on some of the discussion revolving around retention, and I don't have a lot to add to that because Colorado really retains a very small amount of students. But I will say that building a solid program that provides quality instruction with trained teachers has to frame a foundation. Screening, intervention, teacher training and supports must form the basis of a program. Basically, if you retain a student in a program that doesn't provide intervention and support in reading, that student's going to be getting another year of the same type of programming. So Colorado is really focusing on the foundation of the program, and the things that are needed to really assure that we have solid supports for students, and then using retention as a last option. So again, I just want to be clear that the bill that you have in front of you is not Colorado's bill. Alaska is unique, and educators in Alaska understand how to support students. The Alaska bill aligns a preschool program to K-3 by investing in intervention early. The two bills are very different, and they're developed in different ways to meet different needs. And I'd encourage you to be well-versed and the types of preschool implementation and K-3 reading policies across the nation to look for those similarities and differences. So that said, I can say that 30 years of solid research and evidence will show you that if children are supported early and are taught to read using evidence-based systematic processes that include phonological awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary development, and comprehension, that all but 2 to 5% of children will learn to read. And in that, children in Alaska are no different than children in any other state. So that's those are some of the key points that I had, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Galanos. Appreciate your comments and your service here in Alaska, and certainly in Colorado as well. But I appreciate your thoughts about the science of reading, and we have heard that repeatedly, that that sometimes the science of reading is taught incorrectly, or that teachers may not quite understand the best ways to teach reading. I guess my question is, does this bill do enough to bring teachers into the modern world, to make sure that everyone is ready through professional development to take our students forward? Do you have any comments on whether this bill is enough?
So I've read through the bill, and I'm really encouraged at the way that the bill really draws on the research that is out there that talks about how students learn to read. We have, it's not new science necessarily. We have 30 years of research. This started with the research put out by the National Reading Panel in 2000 and continued to be researched in the way that we teach reading and teach children how to decode words. And there are ample resources out there. There are some really solid programs in Mississippi, for example. They've done a lot of work in training their teachers specifically in evidence and science-based reading interventions. There are solid practices out there. And I would say that in Colorado right now, we're going through a review of about 160 instructional programs to review in depth whether or not those curricula presented by vendors are providing evidence-based, science-based reading. So like I said, we're doing a deep dive here in our state to really identify which vendors are providing the best products to be used in districts. And we're also doing a solid review of professional development. So the resources are out there to really help support educators and districts with understanding what evidence-based, science-based reading is and what it looks like and what it is not.
And thank you, Senator Begich.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Angie, Ms. Galanos, a couple of questions for you, if I could. What Senator Stevens was getting at was whether the bill allows for that provision. When you talk about reviewing different curricula and looking at curricula, that's a department function, and I think the department is seeking to do that in regulation. Do you think the bill needs to be stronger, though, in terms of its direction in that regard or not?
I would assure, and I haven't seen any late additions or revisions, but I would really make a clear definition of what you mean when you say science and evidence-based reading. I would define it, and I would clearly outline it in the bill. In Colorado, and that is something that I think could be a lesson gained from Colorado, our legislature was very clear in defining what we meant when we said science and evidence-based reading and defining what it looked like. So I do think that I would want to review the bill just to make sure that that is clearly stated so that there's no daylight in understanding what you mean when you say science and evidence-based reading so that when a district or the department interprets that, that you have the backing in your language to really assure that you're relying on that body of research.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
a couple of follow-ups.
Yeah,
I think that was one of the more detailed elements that we read in the Colorado Reads Act that we actually had not put in the act to try to reduce the sheer volume of the act. But on your recommendation, I think we'll look at that. The you mentioned a couple of things that I just wanted to take note of, and in terms of the teacher development, teacher support, one of the things that the governor has added and the commissioner have added to this bill has been a substantial. In the past, as you know from your experience here, we have not had substantial support from the department for districts. But the bill and the fiscal notes that were reported last hearing actually underscored a significant financial commitment from the administration as well to support districts, to provide training opportunities, and to provide opportunities for people from each district to be trained, as I recall. Are those consistent with the kind of support you believe that you cited that you believe is necessary to ensure that teacher readiness and teacher understanding is there when it comes to teaching children to read?
You know, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that when Colorado reauthorized this bill, that they really put an intentional effort into training all K-3 teachers. So in Colorado right now, the Colorado Department of Education is going to be responsible for training, I think, nearly 60,000 K-3 teachers in evidence-based reading. We've had an RFP that went out, a request for proposals that went out to vendors to see if we could select a vendor who would help us provide that training. It has to be strengthened, whether it's in your bill or you look at it. I think that, and I'm speaking to you as a teacher, when I taught children in Alaska, I didn't know how to teach children to read. I wasn't taught that. I had a master's degree in education, and currently I'm working on my doctorate in education. We're not talking about how to teach reading in our higher ed programs. A lot of districts don't know how to provide the professional development in teaching reading. So supporting teachers with understanding how they can support readers and teach students in a way that really supports that reading trajectory and also helps them identify what a delay in reading looks like is going to be really important. That's one that we've had in Colorado that is important. And as I said, I can tell you as a teacher in Alaska, I wasn't taught how to teach children to read either.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please, Senator.
That's actually encouraging. I think there are two elements in the bill that I think speak to that. One is there's an actual section that talks about the responsibility of the department to train, which I think is good, and to offer trainings. And then there's a secondary bill, which goes to some of your other issues, which is knowing whether we're doing what we say we're doing. So there's some accountability clauses in the bill that really focus on the research components and making sure that we're getting what we need. Last thing I just wanted to ask you right now, and I may have other questions, but right now my last question is, you know, one of the Reading Task Force's findings was a real need to screen for disabilities and learning disabilities. And we're attempting to do that in this bill. We have some sections that relate to that. From your experience, do you think we have enough there, and or if not, what would you recommend that we do to strengthen that section? And just before you answer that parenthetically, one of the things I enjoy about hearing about the Colorado Reads Act is how it continues to evolve. As you get data back, you make quick, nimble adjustments, and I think that's one of our intents with this legislation. We get it started, we measure, and then we make quick adjustments and keep moving the bill forward as each subsequent year happens. But just on the screening for disabilities, dyslexia, those kinds of things, are we doing enough here or not?
So I apologize, because I actually was going to provide an opportunity for you to hear from Alex Frazier, who's a dyslexia expert in our state and who actually currently heads up some of the work that we have with our dyslexia task force, and she works closely with building our dyslexia handbook. So Alex is actually sitting here with me, and what I would say is I can't offer whether or not you're doing enough. I really want to make sure that I have an opportunity to confer, to share. I can say that in our Colorado Read Act, there was a separate bill that was passed in the House last year that really identified that Colorado put in place a dyslexia task force and a dyslexia working group that offered an opportunity for parents and advocates with dyslexia. It was called HB 19-1134, so it passed last year. And that dyslexia working group really gave us an opportunity to hear from stakeholders that were able to review our bill, our legislation, and provide the input and expertise that we needed in order to identify where the shortcomings were in our bill, if we were really providing the screening. They're taking some in-depth looks at the types of assessments that we're using, the types of assessments that are happening across the country, and they're relying on expert testimony in whether or not the assessments that we have are discrete enough to really support the identification of dyslexia. So all that to say, I'm hesitant to answer that off the cuff with this bill, but I would encourage you to really think about dyslexia working groups, dyslexia task force that can really sit down with you and provide the expertise guidance to look to see if your bill is looking for the risk factors in a way that really supports students with dyslexia.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Galanos. We need to move on, but I have a bunch of notes from various senators who sent me things, and Senator Hughes and I were thinking along the same lines about we don't really know what the University of Alaska is doing in terms of teaching the science of reading, and we need to find that out. We need to also I want to ask if you could send your comments in writing to us, Ms. Galanos, if you can do that, and a few other questions we'll get to later. I do want to offer Senator Cockell opportunity to ask a question before we move on.
Probably the main question for this testifier is we're contemplating intervention services and a teaching requirement that we're going to get specialty readers in. And in the intervention, one of my concerns is that the regular first through third grade teachers who aren't in the intervention are not up to the same level of teaching. So in Colorado, was that a concerted effort to try to bring them to the same standard, or was there a mismatch? And that was one of my fears, that we'd find ourselves in a mismatch situation.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I am going to off the cuff agree with you on that one. If you worked in a classroom, you know that I was a special education teacher in the K-3 space, and I can tell you that my work was enhanced by a partnership with the general education teacher. And so as an interventionist, you can provide that intervention and support, but unless you are sending kids back into the classroom for their full day of really receiving enhanced support, that intervention where you're pulling those kids out for maybe, 90 minutes of their day, they need to go back into a classroom that is providing additional supports, additional opportunities to really practice what they're learning. And so that partnership has to happen between the general education teachers and the intervention teachers. So again, I really think looking at the whole system of K-3 general teachers, K-3 interventionists, state systems, district systems, making sure that educational leaders understand the science of reading is probably one thing that I think is going to be really important. But in short, yes, I think that K-3 general ed teachers do need to provide an opportunity to extend learning into the classroom.
Thank you, Mr. Lanos, and good luck on your pursuing your PhD. Clearly, we need to do further work in terms of dyslexia and as well as with the University of Alaska and see that we are, in fact, teaching the science of reading correctly. So at this point, we'll move on to our commissioner, Commissioner Michael Johnson. Pleased to have you with us, sir, and if you'd come forward, please.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Michael Johnson, Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. So my understanding is the hearing is overall about implementation. I know that the retention question is one that the committee is very interested in, so I'll talk briefly, kind of an overview of implementation, and then speak to the retention issue. And thanks for the opportunity to be here again to represent the bill. So the bill is full of elements that will have to be considered for implementation along with the State Board of Education. And as important as the components of the bill is, and I appreciate this committee's thoughtfulness in digging into the bill, will be that if the legislature passes a bill, that we work just as hard to implement it effectively. Some of the big components of the bill that will need to be implemented and that will have to be work that we do with the State Board of Education through regulation and also with school districts, with parents, with teachers, do it as collaboratively as possible so that the implementation will have the greatest chance of success. One of the earliest things will be to develop high-quality pre-K standards. That work's already begun, and we will have to finish that work and the board adopt those pre-K standards because the pre-K program in here is not just any pre-K, it's pre-K that measures up to a standard of quality that is established. Then we have to have a process for awarding the grants associated with that and an application process for districts. The bill will require us to develop implementation around assistance with meeting those standards. So we don't just say here's the standard and meet it, but as you've just been discussing, the department will have to do a lot of work to assist districts and schools in meeting those standards. There's a lot of places in the bill that will require us to provide professional development and training for educators, and those are conversations already going on. And as you all just mentioned, that is absolutely important, and not just for necessarily teachers that are providing interventions, but for every teacher in pre-K through third grade, but even beyond that, because the bill mentions what are you going to do for students that may have been promoted and can't read. We have to select a screening tool and do that in collaboration because most districts now are doing screenings and we certainly want to work with them and what they're doing. Lots of parent notification and resources and involvement and implementing that effectively. Public data reporting and independent data analysis. So as Senator Begich noted, the bill assumes that we're going to continue improving and refining. And whether that's through regulation or future legislation. That data is very important. The last thing that I want to do as commissioner is add bureaucracy to districts that isn't effective for students. And so I want to be continually monitoring that if we pass a bill of this nature, that we're making sure it works for students and not against districts. There's program assessment and evaluation along with that data. So we not only get the data, but then we analyze it. And then a big part of the bill, as you know, one of the three parts is reading-based school improvement. And all of that will have to be with the state board in conjunction with school districts and others implemented and effectively. I want to just touch a moment on the retention or promotion, a reading-based promotion question. This is not a retention bill. It is a bill to give every child the possibility of learning to read. It's been interesting to listen to the conversations and how quickly people will talk about retention and not any of the other great things in this bill. Retention is only one kind of intervention. It's not the only kind. And I would say to all of us, and I'm going to keep reminding myself of this, as we have this discussion, and I'm so grateful that the committee is willing to hear from so many people, but we have to remember it is just as detrimental to a student to minimize the impact of promoting students who are not proficient in reading as it is to overuse retention as an intervention. It's just as detrimental. And so as we consider what's best, we have to keep that in mind. I wouldn't expect anybody to come to this committee and celebrate retention. But there are those who understand it is a legitimate intervention for some students. When people mention intervention, I like to ask, what do you mean by intervention? Because a wide assumption is retention means, what do you mean by retention? That you take one test, and if you don't score at a certain level, you're automatically retained. That is not in this bill. The other assumption that's often made is that if you're retained, you just are going to get the same instruction. And Angie mentioned that very well in her testimony, this bill provides that if you are retained, you're not going to get the same thing. Again, you're going to get what you need. Alaska statute already assumes that retention is possible. 1403.072 requires that each district provide information to parents annually. One of those pieces of information is grade retention standards and policies for elementary school intended. So by requiring schools to report that, the legislature assumes that retention is an intervention that's already in use in at least some school districts. Almost every school district in the state, if not every school district, I didn't go and look at every single school district, but I looked at some, have retention policies in their board policy. Anchorage School District, for example, says the school board recognizes that, especially in lower elementary grades, retention may be necessary to ensure student proficiency in reading and mathematics. When academically appropriate, the superintendent or designee shall promote alternatives to retention among certified staff. Northwest Arctic Borough says retention may be considered when a student has not acquired appropriate and necessary skills and knowledge. Alternative to retention shall be considered. So what's in the Alaska Reads Act regarding promotion and retention? I don't want to go through another sectional analysis and quote every place, but I think there's four categories that I see that we have worked into the bill related to promotion or retention. One is communication. So there's a strong element of communication in the bill. School districts are required to report grade level retention standards and policies as already indicated in statute. That's not new, but it's in here. They also have to explain the implementation of intervention or progression strategies. So what are their strategies for promoting if a student isn't proficient or retention? The second big category is collaboration. Retention can't be made in isolation by one person. It has to be a group of people that includes the parent and the teacher and any other folks that the school determines needs to be involved. It provides guidelines and safeguards. So in the bill, it states a school board may exempt a student from delayed grade level progression for good cause. And then it lists some of those exemptions. And so there's an appeal process, there's exemptions, there's guidelines and safeguards. Currently, the state doesn't mandate any safeguards for retention, it's just allowed. And then there's transparency, the fourth big category. So there's communication, collaboration, guidelines and safeguards, and then there's transparency. Because school districts must report through this bill the number and percentage of students retained and the number of students that are promoted that aren't proficient in reading. And that provides a level of transparency. So the goal is to avoid retention, as Angie said, through quality instruction that results in proficient readers. And for those students that may need extra time and additional instruction, the bill provides for that. So the bill treats promotion and retention in a balanced manner, in my opinion. It gives students, parents, teachers, and administrators the structure needed to elevate all voices to make the best decision possible for each individual student. If you're a parent, this bill requires that you are part of the decision-making process and that you receive information and resources to help your family support your child's learning to read. If you're a teacher, this bill allows retention as one of many interventions you can use to serve your students. And it documents your expertise and your recommendation as a teacher and gives you the flexibility to use retention, whether it be to repeat a whole grade or to repeat part or one subject of a grade. If you're a principal, a superintendent, or a school board member, this bill provides you with a process to make sure there is consistent, thoughtful, and effective decision-making for all of your students, no matter what classroom or school they attend. If you are a legislator, this bill provides you with annual reports regarding the implementation and effectiveness of the Alaska Reads Act, including promotion and retention. And most importantly, if you are a student, this bill provides you with multiple pathways to demonstrate your proficiency and provides evidence-based interventions if you need them and multiple safeguards whether you are promoted without grade-level reading skills or whether you're retained and considered for other interventions.
So thank you. Thank you. Dr. Johnson, I appreciate your calming comments that it's easy to get wrapped around the axle, I think, on retention, when in fact that's not what this is all about. It's about improving the system for our students. You did use a term that I'm not really familiar with, screening tools. What do you mean by that? Is that something we go out and hire a firm to help us with that? How does that work?
Chair Stevens, so a screening tool is an assessment or a tool that we use to identify students that may be not on track to learning to read. So that tool looks different at each grade level. There are vendors that provide that tool. Many school districts in the state have used AIMSWeb. There are other vendors out there providing quality tools. So for example, in first grade, you would be screened to make sure that you're identifying your sounds necessary for phonics. You'll be screened to if you can identify your letters when they're shown to you. All the way up to third grade, you'll be screened to make sure that you're reading fluently enough to comprehend. And so it's a way to a quick measure, so it's not a long 3-day assessment. It's a quick measure to identify and find out if a student may have some may be struggling on the pathway of learning to read.
Thank you. A further question, Senator Begich.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Johnson, I just wanted to thank you for that summary and roundup, which really underscores the work we have put into trying to ensure all voices are heard, that this is a balance that may not include something that may not include everything that I would want in a bill, may not include everything that you would want in a bill, but that does include a comprehensive look at all of these different strategies. And so that was a very, very good summary that I clearly was not capable of providing today. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Hughes.
And I appreciate, too, thank you, Mr. Chair, because the point that you made that a proficiency-based promotion policy is one tool, and it's really the last tool that would come into effect, and I think that's really important to keep that in mind. And the fact that there are exemptions, so we're actually talking about a very small group of students that might be of concern. And one of the things that I, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the bill, we're talking about that not promoting a child should be considered if a child's below proficiency. And my understanding in some of the other states, rather than below proficiency, which is quite broad, and Dr. Winters talked about a certain threshold, a certain line, cut line, my understanding is other states refer to it as far below proficiency. And so I'm wondering if that is something that we should be considering making an adjustment in the language. And because a child that's just a little bit below proficiency could be helped on in the next grade, probably. But if they're far below proficiency, that then is a real concern. Would you agree that we should perhaps fix that?
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Hughes. I haven't seen language, but I just heard that idea in the last couple of days, and I think it's a worthy idea to consider and may make this bill even stronger.
And Mr. Chair, there are two other items, and I don't think we have time today, but in our discussion as the committee regarding the policy before this would move to the Finance Committee is class size and eligibility dates for enrollments as far as whether it's kindergarten, first grade, but actually the 4 and 5 year old cohorts of the two additional cohorts that would be added over a number of years to our present 13 grades, bringing that up to 15 basically cohorts. I think the eligibility dates, and I did have a discussion with Senator Begich, I think that we would, if children are slightly older, it would be very helpful to the teachers all the way through. I think the amount of intervention would be less if children were a little older. And particularly, for instance, for the four-year-old cohort, with a cutoff September 1, you could have a student starting in August that is technically 3 years old. And we know sometimes little boys are lag behind little girls. So you could have a child that is a little boy, and I suppose it wouldn't have to be one gender or the other, who really is not on par as far as readiness and development as some of the other three-year-olds. So you could be looking at a very young, developmentally a child being put in a four-year-old cohort. And I'm concerned about that. So I think the eligibility dates factor into this, and as far as the 4 and 5 year old preparation, as well as the K-1-2-3, that and the class size. I did hear from a teacher, and she made very valid points. She is a first grade teacher with 26 students, and Florida actually has in its constitution a limit of 18 students, kindergarten through third grade. My understanding is the Anchorage School District has their own policy on that. It might be around 20 students. So one of the things I'd like to have a discussion about is class size, and I know that we probably won't be addressing that specifically in this bill, but perhaps encouraging schools or districts, if they don't have a policy, that they really try to keep that ratio very low, because this is going to be a lot more successful is if the classes at K through 3 are smaller, as well as the 4 and 5 year olds.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Very brief response. In response to the discussion I had with Senator Hughes, we have already been talking about adding language in the research section that would reflect part of the report back would be on class size, so that we could actually measure that and then use that as a tool, really, to move forward on the class size discussion. So I think that there's a way to integrate and incorporate that. And also, we are looking at the age issue based on that discussion, so we'll bring those recommendations to the committee.
Thank you. Great discussion. I know there are a lot of questions that we need to yet get into. I do appreciate, Senator Hughes, you're talking about little boys lagging behind little girls, but also not including older boys and older men as well. But I appreciate that. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your comments. We are adjourned.